Hello, Future Asher here. I did want to hop in here and just offer a slight little correction before we get to the episode. In this episode, we're talking about the Qing Dynasty, not the Qin Dynasty. And I kind of was using them interchangeably, so I do apologize for that. But this is the Qing Dynasty. If you are interested in the Qin Dynasty, well, we actually do have an episode on that on this show, Qin Shi Huang and the Qin Dynasty. So I apologize for that little confusion, and I hope you guys enjoy the episode. Thanks for tuning in.
Hello and welcome to Ad Hoc History.
It's not the history podcast you wanted. It's the history podcast you deserve.
That is right. Hello and welcome, everybody. What's up, Luxa?
What's up, Asher?
Not too much. Excited to be here today and to talk a little bit more history. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been a while since we've recorded, and I'm looking forward to getting back into it here.
Hell yeah. So today I have a discussion on the Opium Wars in China and the Century of Humiliation, as it's kind of colloquially known in China, where China had been probably the premier power in the world. And within probably about 70 years, you see a stunning collapse in Chinese power, in Chinese wealth, prestige. And almost a complete reversal from being like this unassailable big dog at the table to just being kicked to scraps and becoming almost irrelevant. And so it's kind of this shattering, cataclysmic decline of Chinese authority in the 19th century.
Yeah, and I think what we're going to see here too is that this was a really concerted effort. This didn't just happen by accident or by happenstance or anything. So this is a really sad story. That's, there's still all kinds of echoes today of what happened here.
Definitely. Yeah, this definitely was not something that just happened on accident. But the Chinese Empire, so the Qin Dynasty was who was in power at this time. They had a lot of problems, and there was a lot of problems kind of in China, kind of below the surface. And it kind of all came to a head, and I won't say a house of cards comes crashing down, but just all of these problems that were had been kind of inherent in the Chinese system, all of a sudden all coming to the forefront at the same time. And what could have really been not that big of a deal becomes like a crisis that kind of spirals out of control and kind of like a fire that starts out as a little blaze, but it just starts burning unhindered and just engulfs the whole house.
All right, so where does our story start today?
All right, so our story starts kind of in the, well, the Age of Discovery. One of the first big thrusts of kind of like the birth of the Age of Discovery was trying to find routes to get to China. Because China has always been one of the major workshops of the world, and they produce all of these goods that are very easy to produce in China, and they can do them en masse and have very high quality at the same time. But elsewhere around the world, these goods are incredibly exotic and incredibly valuable. And so this has kind of always been true for China. This was true back in the Roman days. There's an ancient Silk Road connecting, the markets of the East and the markets of the West. And it's kind of always been this faraway land of riches and mystery to people in the West. And so the desire to find a quicker way there was one of the major reasons that the world kind of turned out to be the way it is, with Europeans discovering the New World, were looking for a direct route to China. So getting to China and getting there faster than having to go through the Silk Road, which is an overland road that takes years, was a huge part of kind of this thrust in the Age of Discovery. And you had, I think, Vasco da Gama kind of kicks it off by he tries to sail around Africa, and he does. He's the first, European to sail around Africa. And so even just this was it had been a huge hurdle in connecting China to the rest of the world by the ocean. You usually have to, sail through the Indian Ocean, take it to the coast of Africa, and then transport it across land, either, through Africa or through the Middle East. So having a direct coastal route to China was something very envious for all the merchants of the world because they wanted to access these rich markets of China. All right, so you with me so far?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right, so this has kind of always been the way things are, but with the discovery of these new routes to the east and the new ships to navigate them, all of a sudden, little tiny kind of upstart powers in Europe, like Great Britain, can start to flex their power, which is their navy, their incredible navy, and they can kind of become this new power in the world because with the opening of these shipping lanes, the world gets a lot smaller. And if you have a fantastic navy, you can kind of go wherever you want and do whatever you want, and no one can really stand up to you. And so, with the advent of this global trade, certain players became very, very powerful, and primarily that was the British Empire. And we've talked about them quite a bit on the show. I'm sure most people are pretty familiar with them, but
You might have
Britain.
heard of them.
Yeah, you might have heard of them. Yeah, they do tend to crop up in history. But during the Middle Ages, England, was a powerful country, but it was nothing like a world power. But these kind of events in Europe have been happening over the past couple hundred years, and it's transformed these societies into incredibly powerful and modern entities. And where a lot of the rest of the world, they haven't had the Industrial Revolution and the farming revolution and the scientific revolution. Haven't had those things. So they still have a much more antiquated, traditional model of governance and of society and of economy and of their military. So you just had this kind of leap forward for a lot of these countries in Europe. And a little small country like England, all of a sudden, well, because it can get anywhere in the world with its navy, and because they have more advanced technology and much better organization than anybody else, they become a serious challenge to pretty much anybody who has a coast, And for China, this was not something they realized, basically. So you have this big kind of leap forward in Europe where you have, the Industrial Revolution, the Scientific Revolution, and it's produced these new, industry that is very, very powerful. And it starts to kind of want to exert its power on a global stage. And so one of the ways that the British kind of were able to exploit their new kind of empire was through trade. That was kind of like the big thing, was that we don't really want to just go and like rule over everybody. I mean, we're down to do that too, don't get me wrong. Like, we're down to rule over people, but the only reason we really want to do it is if we can make a lot of money at the same time. Like, we need places to sell our goods, and we need raw materials to fuel our economy.
And there's a lot of competition going on in Europe. There's a lot, and there has been for a long time. There's a lot of, it's close quarters there. There's a lot of enmity. There's a lot of, I think, willingness on the part of the societies there to want to branch out and get resources from other places to sort of be the big fish in the pond, if you will.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's one of the reasons that those countries emerged so powerful around this time period, is that there's been a tremendous amount of internal competition in Europe. It's kind of like a battle royale, like all the time. Like, everyone's constantly fighting everybody. In China, it was very different. It was had this unified kind of peaceful empire, that really couldn't be more opposite than Europe, which has all of these tiny states that are suspicious of each other, that are rivals of each other. And this kind of mood of rivalry does push a lot of innovation. When you're constantly competing with a bunch of rivals, you're kind of finding new ways to do things,
And
That
China
didn't.
at this point is like really suspicious of, foreign influences, and we're going to see maybe rightly so, right, as this story goes on.
Yeah, so China, has been a place for a long time. The Been an empire for over 1,000 years at this point. And so the conflict's going to start in the 1800s. I think 1839 is when the first Opium War is. So yeah, China's been a state for, 2,000 years at this point. And for the vast majority of that time, there's been some upheaval between these dynasties. When a dynasty falls and a new one takes over, it's very unstable and in very violent periods. But in between, like in the reigns of these dynasties, it's usually pretty prosperous. So you have like these intense warring periods that don't last very long. And then you have this long period of stability and peace. And this was true with the Qin dynasty that had been in power for, I think, about 150 years to this point. They were actually a people of Manchu ancestry. And so this is not the majority population of China, which is Han Chinese, a different ethnicity. The Manchu are from up north, from Manchuria, and they're kind of more akin to like the Mongols and the Jurchen, who were these people from beyond the wall who had kind of always been thought to be barbaric by traditional Han Chinese. Like, so this is kind of an outsider dynasty that takes power in China. They move the capital to Beijing, and they institute a lot of these kind of foreign customs and rules onto this massive population of different ethnicities. So they weren't really well liked, is what I'm trying to say, by a lot of the kind of majority Han Chinese population. And they had very vindictive laws where you had to wear a queue, which is like a little braided ponytail. So all men would have to wear the thing. And if you didn't wear your queue, the sentence was death. So you had like these
So
incredibly
they were
pe
really into this hairstyle.
they were
Okay.
really into this hairstyle, exactly.
Interesting. Okay, so they're just these kind of like really authoritarian measures of control, this ethnic tension. You can see there's a lot of rough adjustments taking place here.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so one of the things that so the Qin dynasty replaces the Ming dynasty. And the Ming dynasty was the dynasty that took over for the Mongol dynasty, the Yuan dynasty. And I think the Ming lasted like 300 years. And this was really at the birth of the Renaissance and the first era of globalization. The Ming was in power. And all of a sudden, you had the New World had been discovered and colonized by Europeans. And the Spanish had even found a route, across the Pacific to get to China. And so during the reign of the Ming Dynasty, all of the wealth of the New World starts flowing into China, and that wealth was primarily in silver. And the Ming Dynasty had had to rebuild the Chinese economy after the collapse of the Yuan Dynasty. And one of the things that the Yuan Dynasty was famous for was its paper-based money and its credit system. And Marco Polo writes about this, how the great Khan of the Yuan dynasty had discovered the secrets of alchemy, and he describes it. It's paper money, and they would take the bark of the mulberry tree, and the mulberry tree is what silkworms eat, and they'd pulp it up and make this paper out of it, and you'd have all these inspectors would stamp it on pain of death. And this was the only thing legal to use in China was this paper money. And so all the foreign merchants that would go to China, they'd have to acquire this paper money. Then they'd go to the market and they could only use the paper money. They couldn't trade directly in goods. But
And so we're all familiar with this system because this is how it is most places you go now, right? Like,
exactly, yeah.
yeah.
So unsurprisingly, there was a traumatic, a lot more money was created than probably should have been created, as tends to happen in this situation. And the Chinese economy had a really, really rough spurt of it there at the collapse of the Yuan dynasty. It just had incredible amounts of debt and just kind of chaos rippling through the economy. So when the Ming took over, they changed their economic model. And they said, we are only going to accept real money, hard currency. And for the Chinese, that was silver. That was like their gold, was
Okay.
silver. And so it serves the same function as gold, basically. It's really good money. It's very pretty. It's desirable and it's very, very difficult to destroy. It endures, it
It's
just
useful
makes,
for a lot of things, yeah.
yeah, useful a lot of things. It makes really good money. And so the only way you could acquire goods in China after this in the Ming Dynasty period was by trading silver. They didn't want anything else, So one of the kind of benefits of trade is the emergent properties of it, where if, I'm in, Britain, let's say we have a bunch of sheep and we make really good wool. Okay, well, wool is super common in Great Britain because we have a bunch of sheep. So everybody has a bunch of wool, So you can't really sell the wool for very much in Great Britain. But if you take it somewhere else in the world where they don't have wool, all of a sudden you can trade that wool for stuff that you don't have back where you live. And both sides have made a bunch of money in the process. And so it has this kind of emergent properties to it. And that's why, countries prefer to not have a trade deficit, where if you're trading on equal terms, that means there's no money actually leaving either country. You're just trading goods that you produce. And so this is the ideal for trade. But when all of a sudden the Qing or the Ming Dynasty is no longer accepting goods. They only want hard currency. And so this puts anybody who wants to go to China in kind of a bind because you don't want to load your ship up with a bunch of money because money's already valuable. You want to load it up with stuff that's not very valuable and then take it somewhere where it is valuable, right?
Yeah,
So
so it's like if you have to go to China, you're gonna have to make an extra stop first to sell all your stuff to get the silver if there's somebody that will buy it for silver, right? It sounds
yeah, exactly.
complicated. Yeah.
And so ultimately, this led to a situation where pretty much all of China's trade partners were kind of running a trade deficit. And that means that there's more money entering into China than leaving China. Because they didn't really want to buy anything that they were selling either, you know? So China had an incredible economy, an incredible kind of labor pool. And you had these, you know, craftsmen that were making incredibly fine goods, you know, silver, silks, porcelain, these kind of things that,
Yeah, well, we all know how much the British love the tea, right?
yeah,
That was a
tea's
huge
like one
part
of
of it. Yeah.
a huge one, yeah. And so really, like these kind of European powers are finding themselves in a situation that they're not happy with, basically. We want to trade with China. We want to be traders. We don't want to be importer exporters or wholesalers. You know,
Yeah, we're
because it
kind
just
of at a disadvantage here and we don't like it. Yeah.
exactly, yeah. And so now the way that the Chinese saw this is that there was a lot of kind of, I guess, arrogance in the Chinese imperial courts, in the Qing court. And the common sentiment was that these people were foreign barbarians. You know, they've been coming to us for thousands of years. This is really no different. They're still coming to us. We can just kind of treat them however we really want to treat them. And as long as they, you know, effectively kiss our butts, you know, it's fine. And so they had the kind of like really humiliating court rituals where if you wanted to have an audience with the emperor, you had to kowtow.
Okay. So it was like really flexing here. Like, you know, we have a huge upper hand and we really want to like make that apparent.
And I guess there was kind of this thought, and this has probably been true for many emperors, but that the Chinese emperor was kind of like the king of the world. And it's not
This
that,
sounds familiar.
yeah, he's like the emperor of all the other emperors. And like, no one would dare attack China because we have so many people and we have so much money. So everyone just wants to come to us and be friends with us and pay us tribute and kowtow to us. And this has been going on for hundreds of years. And so I think this kind of attitude developed where maybe you're just kind of taking things for granted that, you know, everyone who shows up at your doorstep is there because they want to, you know, genuflect at your feet and pay you tribute. But
The geometric progression would suggest that that would be the case, right? If that's how it's always been and has been for a long time, and if it's the society is pretty insular, meaning that you don't have a lot of, you know, news coming in about what's going on overseas and stuff. I mean, that those seem like reasonable assumptions to make, right?
yeah. And so this is kind of the situation that they were finding themselves in. And so, meanwhile, the Industrial Revolution has happened and it's really changed the game, but it doesn't make its way back to China. And it was very insular. You know, the emperor lives in the Forbidden City where, like, he doesn't even leave. It's like illegal for people to look at the emperor, you know, like he's cut off from everything, you know, and has this massive imperial bureaucracy built up. All these advisors, all these, you know, concubines, this weird family. It's incredibly messy style of, you know, maybe one would say like a decadent government for a regime that's been in power for hundreds of years and hasn't really ever been tested. And
A lot of bureaucracy, yeah.
they just weren't able to make the internal adjustments to Chinese society. And, you know, primarily when it came to scientific and industrial innovations, they had always done things a certain way in China and it always worked. You know, they had their own model on science and medicine, and there was no reason to adopt or even pay attention to what these foreign barbarians that are coming to our shores, we're not going to their shores. We have no idea where they live, you know? So I think it kind of instilled this kind of mentality of aloofness and arrogance in the ruling caste of China. And so when this thing does kind of break out into an actual war, they are not ready for what's at their doorsteps. And furthermore, corruption is a huge problem in China. It's always been a huge problem. It is during this time. And one way that the Qing dynasty had set up their trade was with something called the Canton system. And so Canton is a major city in southern China. It's on the Pearl River, which has this huge estuary that flows into the South China Sea. And that's where like Hong Kong and Macau are. But if you wanted to trade in China, you'd have to go to Canton. So you'd have to sail up the Pearl River, and it's like this kind of closed trade city. And all of the trade in China has to go through this one place, basically all the foreign trade. And it's controlled by these like syndicates, like these merchant syndicates. I think there was like 12 of them, which were all ran by like one man. So you basically had tw 12 men running all of the trade in China. And this is the wealthiest country in the world. And so you can imagine how much money and power this little clique of merchants had in Canton.
Sure. Yeah, it sounds like it. I could see that.
Yes, imagine if all trade in the United States ran through 12 people, you know, like,
I mean, we're headed in the direction, but yeah.
So it just was a system ripe for corruption. And one of the things that was happening is that these merchants were basically not following the laws and were allowing smuggled goods to enter China. And this would be a way to avoid the tariffs that the Chinese government would place on foreign goods. And so
Okay,
if you just
gasp. Super surprising that this is happening. Yeah,
smuggling, I
okay.
know, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this kind of creates this situation where we have this Canton system, all trade is being filtered through this one city. It's going to the hands of like 12 incredibly rich and powerful men. The richest man in the world at this time was one of these syndicate holders in China, in Canton. You know, so these are the richest people in the world, basically. Anyways, the point is that it created a situation where smuggling was very advantageous to the foreigners. They could, but they had to find something that the Chinese wanted because they didn't really want most of the stuff made in Europe. They just wanted money. And so what the British East India Company came up with was opium. Opium had been very popular in China and other places, and the British East India Company had just taken over large swaths of India, which should be another interesting episode, really.
Yeah, we should go over there because that's another part of this whole kind of story at some point. So, yeah.
And so the East India Company is really interesting unto itself. It's like, you know, it's a corporation, but it's has like royal charters, and you know, a lot of high people in the British society own stock in this thing, and it's part, like kind of their venture. So it has all these kind of like monopoly concessions, and it can conquer territory, it can hold armies, and it was it, like
And
the
it's
it.
able to do things without the finger being directly pointed back at the British government, right? Which is another handy thing about it. And this isn't crazy too. I mean, this was common in Europe to like hire privateers and stuff like that, like basically pirates that would be in your employ to go and like harass foreign ships and maybe take their stuff or whatever. Like that was pretty common.
And this was just kind of like that same phenomena on like a huge scale. But it's very similar to like the privateers. But anyways, yeah, so they, you know, they conquer India, they chase out the Mughal dynasty, and they're trying to figure out, well, what can we grow? And they say, okay, well, we can grow opium poppy here. And India is like the perfect place to grow it. And all of a sudden, we don't have to bring hard silver to China. We can just stop in India, pick up a bunch of opium and bring it up there. And then we'll sell it on the black market in Canton. And so this is kind of what they started doing. Opium, you know, the effects of opium were well known in Europe. It was illegal in Europe. Most people deplored it. It was not like a popular. Doing this would not have been popular with the population, you know, selling
Okay.
drugs, as you might
So
expect.
this was like a hush-hush thing. It wasn't like, "Hey everybody, we're growing opium in India and selling it to China now." Like,
Yeah,
okay.
it wasn't something they were going to come out and brag about. It was something viewed as very deplorable. But as it starts to catch on and there's so much money being made, it really does start to become institutionalized that, you know, oh, it's okay for us to sell it in China. They like it. It's part of their society. It's not part of our society. You can't sell it here. But in China, it's fine, you
It's
know?
totally fine for them to do it. Yeah. So we can, I mean, obviously we can see a lot of like, you know, like racism and other types of thinking that come into this. Obviously, yeah. So not strange at the time at all either, to have these kinds of assumptions, I suppose. So yeah.
And you know, as this goes on and on, the amount of money coming out of it is just staggering. The Delano family was involved in this. That's the two Roosevelt presidents were related to this guy, who was one of the most wealthy merchants in the world, who kind of started that kind of, political dynasty that would later have two presidents. He was in this opium trade. So there's American merchants involved as well. All kinds of merchants are getting out in the action, and there's just so much money to be made that any kind of moral kind of lingering doubt is just kind of cast aside to focus on the giant pile of money. And
As so often happens.
yep. So it's just one of those deals. But finally, the British have found their trade that they can do with China. And they actually have something that the Chinese want to buy, and it's the opium. And so they start flooding it into Canton, into southern China. And, they are basically smuggling it in with the help of these really corrupt businessmen. All right. So that's kind of laying the stage of, why we got to where we are, pretty much about economics,
Yeah, a lot of things do come back to economics and resources, really. I mean, that's a huge factor in a lot of motivations that we see in history.
All right, so we've kind of established, the grounds for why there might be a conflict here, but it kind of comes to a head eventually in 1839. And the emperor finally sees, is starting to see the disastrous effects of all of this opium smuggling, and it's profoundly affecting the society. It's even reaching his own court where people are starting to just smoke opium all day and just like not do anything. And so the Chinese emperor outlaws opium and forbids the smoking of it, makes it completely illegal. And he appoints a inspector to go to Canton and to clean up this mess that's been brewing down there, and to stamp out the opium trade, basically. And this is Viceroy Lin Zexu, and he's kind of a legendary character in China, a real law and order type guy. I guess he was like incorruptible and very loyal to the emperor. And so he goes to Canton and he's determined to crack down on the smuggling and destroy the opium entering the country. And so he gets to Canton, he comes with like a small army, and they basically just start going into all the warehouses and finding all the opium and just taking it. And so they're kind of raiding all the foreign warehouses. They're arresting the smugglers, and they just took all the opium. And they've gathered it all together in one place. And the British were not happy about this. They said, "Yeah, you're stealing our trade goods." They disputed that opium was illegal, and but yeah, Lin didn't care, so he took all the opium. And in 1839, he has this giant destruction of the opium where they start throwing all of it into the Pearl River. And he makes like a little poem of lament for the poor fishes of the river, because they dumped like 220 tons of opium into the river. And this would have been millions and millions of dollars worth of value that was just kind of destroyed when he does this. And so obviously, this pissed off the British. And they determined that they're the primary culprit. They're the ones bringing all this crap in. And they ban them from trading in the port of Canton. And they tell them they just have to leave. And they make it illegal for anybody to sell them food or to support them in any way. So they tell them, just fuck off, go away, go back to wherever you came from. No one's going to sell you food. No one's going to sell you water. And they just kind of hope that this will kind of solve the problem, basically.
Sure. I mean, yeah, and they're like, "Okay, we're 100% enemies now. You all have to leave. Don't fucking come back. Don't pass go." Right? Yeah, that makes sense, right? This is logical.
Yeah, and like they're not like enemies as in there's no open hostilities, but they're just not welcome there anymore.
Sure. Persona non grata.
Yeah. And so the British have to leave, and this is they're leaving a lot of money and prestige in the Pearl River there, where this huge economic venture that had made people the richest people in the world, that's how much money's at stake here, is all of a sudden being ripped from them. And this is obviously does not make them happy. So they leave the Pearl Delta, and they kind of go off around some islands around near Macau, And they're basically looking for food and water, and said, no, everyone's is refusing to trade with them. And so eventually the guy in charge of it, a guy named of Elliot, starts making demands at just like a small port that, hey, if you're not going to give us the food and water, we're going to take it. And the Qing garrison refuses, and the British open fire on the coastal defenses at the delta of the Pearl River. They seize the necessary supplies and they start deciding what are we going to do? And so word comes back from England that they want to have a response, and we're going to send reinforcements. We're going to send pretty much our best warship, probably the best warship in the world. It was the first steam-powered ship. It was still mostly built out of wood, but it had these big steam wheels on the side of it. It was called the Nemesis, and this was, yeah, probably the finest warship in the world. So they send a naval reinforcement brigade. They send a bunch of ships down there to link up with the East India Company ships that had been kicked out of Canton. And we are basically, this is kind of like the start of the Opium War. All right, so is that all making sense?
Yeah, this is making sense for sure. And it's interesting how much this is like kind of echoes things that we see in, as is so often the case in history, but how much we see echoes of it in the present day.
It is interesting, and I thought that's something we could kind of talk about maybe when we're done with like the narrative, just kind of talk about the similarities and some of like the stuff still going on today in the world that's kind of reminiscent of this. There is another incident that happens. There is two Chinese sailors get drunk in this little town that they seized, and they murder a Chinese peasant, and the Chinese authorities want
Sorry,
to.
two English sailors?
Yeah, two English sailors.
Okay.
The Chinese authorities want to arrest them and put them on trial. But the British felt that the Chinese legal system was very unjust, and they refused to let these sailors stand trial under Chinese law. Instead, the British, I forget the name of the position, but the leader of the expedition basically decides to have his own trial for the soldiers, and he invites some of the Qing like diplomats to attend the trial, but he refuses to submit them to Chinese law because he thought they'd be tortured and murdered, and maybe they would have been, maybe that was the law in China, so it's just kind of like, but it does kind of bring up one of the major points in this is that the Western powers in China do not want to abide by Chinese law. And this will be something at the end of the war that is part of the humiliation of China. It's called extraterritoriality, where if our people commit crimes in your country, they are not tried under your laws, they're tried under our laws in your country. And so the British don't want to surrender these two sailors. The Qing want to arrest them. There's a small battle fought. I think there's like 15 Chinese soldiers killed, no British soldiers killed. And that's kind of like the first kickoff of the hostilities, like the first actual battle. But the British move their fleet to the Pearl Delta, and they are determined to blockade Canton. Again, this is the lifeblood of the Chinese economy. This is where they're making all this money in the city of Canton. So if we can blockade it, well, then we can, do a ton of damage to them. And
And the
so
goal here is to get the Chinese to start trading with them again, or I'm kind of confused now about like what's the goal of this operation?
yeah, so there's like four stated war objectives. They wanted to end the Canton system, or at the very least, open up other ports. China has this massive coastline with all these ports, but all trade has to go through Canton. So we want to open up other trade ports. That was like the number one war goal. Number two was to secure an island in the area, which they will go on to do with Hong Kong. Number three was to, I think, have this extraterritoriality. So we can basically operate under our laws in your country.
Because that's what we're used to doing in the other places we occupy. Yes, okay.
And I think the fourth one was ensuring the spread of Christian missionaries. They were very keen to spread Christianity here, and they wanted to be allowed to do that. So those were kind of like the four war
Let us
aims.
sell you our drugs and tell you about our God.
Yeah. And so this isn't a conquest. This is not a war of conquest. They're not trying to take over China.
They just want to have like a, economic superior position in China. They don't want to take it over. They just want to have it be like sort of like part of their little like necklace.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, tomato, tomato in a way, right? They definitely want a situation where China has a lot less sovereignty than it does now.
Absolutely.
Okay.
They wanted to behave like other European countries do, where it's not the locus of all civilization. It's just another point in a trade network. And if we want to trade with you, we shouldn't have to jump through all these hoops, We don't have to do that anywhere else, so
And
you.
China's like, well, we don't even care about trading with you. Like, we don't want you here. So,
Yeah, pretty much. They're saying, well, you came to us. We didn't come to you. So if you want to trade with us, then you got to jump through the hoops. That's just how it is, That's the honor of trading with us. Like, you're making a bunch of money. You wouldn't be here if you weren't. And so there is just kind of a different mindsets, But yeah, this was never, let's destroy the Qing dynasty and colonize China. This was purely about like business ventures and economics and laying the foundations for further profit in the future.
Well, and I don't know if they would have had the sort of like manpower to do that. China's a big place with a big population. Like, an outright military victory wouldn't have been very feasible, I don't think. But
Oh
I could
no,
be wrong.
completely unfeasible. Yeah, China could
So this
muster
economic
probably.
situation is much more of a feasible way to kind of get similar results, maybe.
Yeah. And, governing an empire is very expensive, and trying to, stabilize the country, it all costs a lot of money, and lots of times it's just not worth it. You spend way more money on your little colony than you ever make off of it. So in this case, yeah, they weren't looking to colonialize it. They just wanted to trade with them and have all of these kind of barriers erased.
They wanted to exploit them, I think, is what you're looking for there
Well,
in some
they
ways. I
did,
think,
yeah.
yeah, they
They
wanted to exploit them like they had been doing other places and like others had been other places. So, yeah.
Yes, but it yes, it was very exploitative that we want to sell our drugs to you, and you're gonna frickin' like it kind of deal. But it's also wrapped up in this kind of the world's changing. You need to change also. Like, you can't just be this isolated place that everybody has to come kowtow to you. Well, you're no longer strong enough to act that way.
Yeah, this power dynamic is no longer the same as it used to be. Like, we have all these fancy weapons now and stuff. And so, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and so and there was all these attempts to prevent this. The guy in charge of this expedition to Canton, he had a letter to the emperor, and he wanted to, formally request these amendments to their trade deal. But in his audience with the empire, he refused to kowtow, which is where you get down on your hands and knees, and you put your face to the ground and slowly approach. This is how you had to talk with the emperor, and he agreed to kneel to him and to salute him, but he refused to kowtow. So it's just
What's the fucking
sensibilities,
difference? I mean, Jesus, whatever.
But anyway, so that was the goal, and the other goal was to get most favored nation trading status with China, meaning that we're going to have the best possible trade agreement with you. There's going to be no other foreign competitor that has a better trade deal. We want to have the best deal.
Yeah, if your dog has puppies, we get the first pick of the litter.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, these are the British war aims. The
Okay.
Chinese war aims were to stomp out the opium crisis.
Yeah, to like help the civilization recover from this horrible, drug epidemic.
Yeah, and to get rid of these foreign barbarians. And you're right. So the Chinese military at this time could muster hundreds of thousands of troops, massive armies, but they're not equipped very well. At least it's more of like a middle age armament. It's not up to snuff to what the Europeans have. And the Chinese has a huge navy. But again, it's the same problem. They have these war junks that were really good for hundreds and hundreds of years. But going up against these like modern British ships, some of them powered by steam, they cannot compete. And so while the British have a much, much smaller size as far as their military forces, the quality of the British forces are on a magnitude higher. than what the Chinese can provide. So when they do come to blows, the British gunships and the British Navy just annihilates anything in their path. And they can shoot stuff from way further away than they can be shot at. And so all these coastal defenses that are built on the Pearl Delta for this very reason, to protect against naval attack, they're completely useless. And the Chinese Navy has to get super, super close if they want to fight the British. And they're just sitting ducks for their guns and rockets and stuff. So militarily, the British have realized that, well, yes, they are very powerful still and very wealthy. If we can just have these kind of short, decisive battles, we can win these battles easily. And the whole state isn't organized well enough to kind of channel all of its resources into defeating us. It's going to be an ad hoc kind of affair. We can beat a garrison here, we can beat an army there, but we're never going to be facing the full fury of China coming down on us all at once. It's just going to be a little trickle of resistance. And that's kind of exactly how it played out. And
Yeah,
so
okay.
they're blockading the Pearl Delta. And there is a British ship, actually, a smuggler ship, that tries to run the blockade. They try to get to Canton past the British flotilla. And the British ships fire on them. They fire some warning shots telling them to go backwards. Well, the Chinese fleet that's in the Delta, in the river, they see this ship and they assume it's an enemy of the British. And they start rushing to try to help the ship that's being harassed by the British Navy. And so the British see the Chinese fleet moving at them and they just open fire. And it's just a complete disaster for the Chinese Navy. I think they may have killed like one or two British sailors, but they suffered hundreds of casualties. I think three of their ships were destroyed in the first volley. And so, like, really, there's nothing stopping the British Navy now from just sailing down the rivers. They can't really stop them. So there's like this first battle, which kind of sets the tone of how these battles are going to be. They're going to be incredibly one-sided.
All right, so the British sail into Canton.
They sail up the river, and the emperor has no idea what's happening. He's been sent all these dispatches from very maybe optimistic local officials that have reported, the British have been defeated. British fleet destroyed, British defeated. So
I
you.
wonder if this is the kind of situation where bringing bad news can be an unhealthy thing for a person. So
Yes, it
all of a
definitely can
sudden, the
be. Yeah.
chain of intelligence becomes rather murky.
Yes. A lot of people that failed in their leadership duties to take care of the British were executed when they failed to do that. So, yes, it probably was very dangerous to report the truth. So anyways, the court in Beijing, which is like 1,000 miles away from Canton, they're hearing about all these victories. They have no idea what's going on. But the reality is that when the Chinese military, the Qin military, is facing up against the British military, they're getting soundly defeated in every single way. And they're barely inflicting any casualties on the British. Anyway, so they sail up the river to Canton. They take over the city. They land some troops. They fight some battles. And they basically seize the city. And then they decide to sail up the coast of China, up to around the Yellow Sea, or I'm sorry, the Yellow River, and they want to take over the Yellow River and kind of cut off China, cut off the interior of China. And they start going from city to city. They take over this big island over there, and it's going very, very poorly for the Chinese. Eventually, the emperor kind of realizes what's happening, and he raises an army of 50,000 men and sends it to Canton to try to crush the rebellion. It does not go well. The army is soundly routed, and the British have basically won every single battle in this kind of short war. This has only been going on for about 2 years.
Okay, so but the Chinese are probably starting, the leadership is starting to see the writing on the wall here about, whatever they're sending after this foreign invading force is just getting hammered out. Like, at what point do you have to maybe sue for peace or whatever?
Yeah, that's pretty much what ends up happening is that they are unable to militarily defeat the British, and they kind of have to come to terms. And eventually, there is a treaty that's kind of hammered out. It kind of opens the way for further trade in China. It's not like super humiliating, but this will be the first of the unequal treaties where we're going to cede land to you. We're going to have these foreign concessions. You can have the island of Hong Kong. It's yours. You can have little sections of our cities chopped off where that's now part of your country. It's a foreign concession, and our laws do not apply there. And they do agree to pay a huge indemnity for all the destroyed opium. So they have to pay back the British merchants that lost all their trade goods.
Gods.
We have to give you the
Okay.
island of Hong Kong, and we have to allow this extraterritorial law and order for your citizens while they're in China. And our laws no longer apply in your foreign concessions. And while your people are in our country, our laws do not apply to them either. They can do whatever they want as long as it's supposedly according to their native country's laws. So that's kind of the result of this first opium war, is that it's a humiliating defeat for the Chinese. It's not like a crushing military defeat, though. It's not like they lost their entire army. They lost some battles, they lost some ships, they got humiliated, they had to sign this first kind of unequal treaty and kind of give in to the demands that they did not want to do. They didn't want to open up the other cities. They didn't want to allow opium to be traded, you know. They didn't want the Christian missionaries coming in, and they didn't want to give the British most favored nation trading agreement. But they're kind of forced through this this first treaty, the Treaty of Nanking, it's called.
All right.
And that's the first opium war. And this kind of unleashes a crisis in China where for millennia, we've been number one. We've been able to do what we want in China, and our power's radiated out across the rest of the world. Our culture and our economy is so massive that it's a magnet for everyone all around the world, and they're just drawn to us. But all of a sudden, we can no longer protect our sovereignty, and we're getting bullied by these foreign barbarians who come from a place we don't even know where it is, you know? So it's a shocking kind of moment for the Qin Dynasty and starts off this major crisis in Qin China.
Now, are the British still importing a lot of opium at this point?
They are, and they're not the only ones. So part of the treaty was that opium trade is going to be legalized now. And we're going to get rid of this Canton syndicate system where instead of having just Canton, they open up five more cities along the coast of China. And these are going to be the other entry points for goods entering and exiting China. And we're no longer going through this 12 businessmen kind of system. We want to trade directly with, you know, average traders, and there's lots more smuggling to go on, of course, but other countries start jumping in and start, okay, well, where can we grow opium? And where, you know, this is huge money. Any kind of drug dealing, you know, as we know today still is massively profitable. And so yeah, the United States gets in on it, France gets in on it, other European countries get in on it, and China just kind of no longer has the internal sovereignty to say, no, you cannot import drugs into our country.
All right, yeah, so we can see that there's a lot of problems for Chinese society that's probably going to continue to happen as a result of this, right?
Yeah, I can only imagine, but yeah, I imagine it was pretty bad.
Because this
Just
isn't there more of this conflict?
so this is the first Opium War, yeah. There is a second one.
Okay, I thought so. You said this was
Yeah,
the first.
yes. There, it's 16 years later, and it's really not that different than the first one. It's pretty similar. It gets kicked off by a British registered ship. It's called the Arrow, that gets raided in Canton Harbor, and the crew gets arrested. But this kind of sets off this diplomatic crisis, and the treaty that had been ratified after the first Opium War was not being followed. The Chinese are still trying to crack down on smuggling. They're trying to get rid of the opium trade, and we don't like that, you know. And they arrested our ship, you know. So that's kind of like the pretext that starts off the second Opium War. And the difference with that one is that the French get involved. And the second Opium War is more punitive. They actually take their demands to Beijing this time. Said, oh, the emperor's just so far away, he doesn't know what's going on. Surely, if we just go straight to him, we can work something out. So, in the Second Opium War, they actually attack Beijing. They burned down the Summer Palace, which was apparently one of the most beautiful palace complexes in the world. It gets destroyed during the war. I actually don't have that much on the Second Opium War, but it's kind of more of the same.
Okay. I mean, I think a war is almost kind of like, I might give it another name too. Like, interesting though. Yeah, okay. So the Chinese aren't following along with the agreement to the British's satisfaction. There's been this, police action or whatever on this ship, and time to like go remind the Chinese that, we've got the bigger, cooler boats and better guns and stuff.
Yeah, pretty much exactly. Yeah. And then when their diplomats get to the Forbidden City, the emperor refuses to see them, and he seizes some of them and kills them, And the Qing Dynasty, for its part, did a lot to escalate the problems. But at the end of the day, you had a bunch of foreigners coming up to your shore and demanding to sell drugs. It's pretty easy to see how they would be upset about that and not wanting to follow these previous treaties.
Yeah, not only that, but to, a lot of times people are uncomfortable with, evangelism and things like that coming into their territories, right?
Yeah, and the major event that happens in between the two Opium Wars is called the Taiping Rebellion. We've talked about it a little bit on the show, but it's an epic conflict. It's probably a civil war would be much more accurate to call it, the Taiping Civil War. And it's this massive uprising in southern China by a man who claims to be related to Jesus Christ. And they want to start this new Christian China, basically, Heavenly Taiping. And so this is one of the largest conflicts in human history. There's thought to be 20 to 30 million deaths in this war. So this is like a world war scale conflict with the amount
Wow.
of deaths happening.
And this was because of ideological religious stuff?
Yeah, it's a crazy story. I don't have too much on it today, but there was this man, look up his name real quick.
And I know we have talked about this before. I can't recall the exact episode that it was in, but I do remember us talking about, I think we were talking about some of the fighting styles that they used during this, which we found interesting.
Yeah, we've brought it up a few times. Yeah. There was this guy named Hong Zhuquan, Zhuquan, and he was an ethnic Han, which is that separate majority ethnicity from the Mongol dynasty, or the I'm sorry, the Manchu dynasty, the Qin dynasty. So he's of this kind of ethnic majority, and he was growing up to be in the Chinese civil service. And so one of the reasons China has been so successful as a state is that they've had a civil service for thousands and thousands of years, where it's kind of like a meritocracy where if you know all the legal codes, if you're really smart, you have to pass these examinations. And if you can pass the examinations, you can work in the bureaucracy, in the civil service. And so Hong was somebody growing up to aspire to be part of this bureaucratic class in China. But when he took his exams, he failed. And he had this like crushing kind of I know crisis of his whole life had been for naught. He was rejected from the civil service and he got really sick at the same time. And like while his life is on the line and while his identity is basically shattered, there are these Protestant pamphlets resting by his hospital bed. And he starts reading about Christianity. And he starts having these visions, basically, where Jesus comes to him and tells him that he's his brother. He's like the brother of Jesus. And he is supposed to have this big rebellion in China and overthrow the Qin dynasty and make this new heavenly kingdom, Heavenly Taiping. And so this is the leader of the rebellion, is this kind of prophetic, radical Christian.
All right.
Yes, so it has, and probably a lot of the, Christianity that was spreading in southern China through these ports, through the traders, through parts of the peace treaties was having a subversive effect when you got to people like Hong Zhuquan. But it's a very complicated rebellion, but eventually it arises in southern China. It becomes this popular movement where it's kind of like a revolution where all of the peasants are flocking to this guy, and he's like this holy man, like this prophetic holy leader, and he's going to cast down the corrupt foreign regime that's been ruling over us and create this new heavenly kingdom of Taiping in China. So that's kind of how it starts, but it just becomes this incredibly bloody war. I don't have too much on that actual conflict itself, but this thing was, again, one of the largest conflicts in human history. And so this was happening in the background during the Second Opium War.
That's what a fucking mess.
Yes, it's just a complete disaster in China. And so they basically lost control of southern China. You have these massive armies that have set up rival countries. And at the same time, well, these barbarian foreigners, they're showing up again with their damn ships, and we can't really stop them, you know. And our main kind of focus is on the rebellion, where there's millions of people fighting each other. But that's when the foreigners come back, when the Qin Dynasty is completely embroiled in this massive civil war. Well, that's when the Second Opium War breaks out. And while the Qing Dynasty tries to get rid of them, you know, they try to build up their coastal defenses, have more modern cannon, but it's just not enough. And with the French getting involved as well, their kind of casus belli was that there was a murder of a French missionary in southern China, and to demand justice, they were going to get involved with this war with the British. And so they kind of team up on the very beleaguered Qin Dynasty and really bully the crap out of them by taking the Forbidden City, taking their summer palace, just kind of exerting their power right into the heart of Imperial China.
Burning
And
down their cool, place that was, super sacred in their culture, right? Like this is like a, there's a psychological effect to doing things like this, right? Like
oh, absolutely, yeah. Burned down the Summer Palace, yeah, which was like a marvel of architecture and art. Yeah, it's beautiful. I think for probably a lot of Chinese, symbol of oppression of this kind of government they hated. The Qing Dynasty was not popular. They were
okay.
viewed as foreigners that were overlording themselves onto this Han majority. But something curious happens. You know, this civil war does not finish by the time the Second Opium War finishes. It's still going on. And the British and French actually ally themselves with the Qing Dynasty to help put down the Taiping Rebellion. And at first, people were in Europe were like, oh, this is great. There's a Christian uprising in China. This is awesome. You know, China is going to become Christian. But once they started hearing the gospel of Hong Xiuquan, he was saying some super radical shit. Like, he's the brother of Jesus.
The British hear what's actually being said. They're maybe not so on board with this new version of Christianity emerging in China.
Yes. Originally, this was very viewed very optimistically. But yeah, once they start hearing the gospel being espoused, they quickly side with the Qing dynasty, provide them with the means to eventually suppress and destroy this revolt. The Taiping Rebellion, they did capture Nanjing, one of the major cities in China, and they made that their capital. So they kind of had, it was kind of like two Chinas for a while. And the leaders of the revolt start turning on each other, butchering, you know, their own family. It's kind of
Oh
like,
no. Yeah,
yeah, like these
that sucks.
commoners that all of a sudden became emperors, they were not able to handle the newfound power and they turn on each other.
And we see
And
this happening sometimes with these, revolts and
oh,
stuff.
absolutely. It happens all the time with the Roman generals and stuff.
I'm thinking about the French Revolution too. I mean,
Sure, yeah.
yeah.
So yeah, the internal politics of Heavenly Taipei completely disintegrate. And the Qing is able to rally an army with the help of the British and French and crush the rebellion and crush, take over Nanking and destroy Heavenly Taipei once and for all.
And it would make sense that it would be in the best interest of the Europeans that there would be this authoritarian rule in China that is a puppet to them. That makes
Exactly.
total
They have all
sense.
these
So, yeah.
treaties with them. If Taiping wins the war, all of our treaties with the previous government go out the window, right? So that was definitely part of it. And the treaties that they're able to extract after the Second Opium War are very, very unequal. And the Chinese have to pay back like a tremendous amount of silver. And so you had this country that was the most wealthy country in the world, that had the most money in the world, the most silver, all of a sudden, just to make the British and French go away and to focus on this internal rebellion, we're going to have to give away pretty much all of our wealth. And they, I think it's like 24 million pounds of silver is having to be transferred. And so the vast hundreds of years of trade surplus is kind of wiped away by these wars. And all of the money that had accumulated in China starts leaving the country. And they have to basically finance their governments with debt to these very same Europeans. So China never had a robust banking system. They had a much more primitive, I guess much less sinister banking system. But that one thing that that did do is that it made the state much more reliant on its own devices. It couldn't just accumulate wealth out of nowhere like the financial institutions in Europe allowed their governments to do. And the only place that could provide that liquidity to them were those European banks. So they have to go into debt to pay back the Europeans by borrowing money from European banks, you know? So it's just like a really
Real
bad
double
financial.
bind situation there. Yeah, like the Europeans have sailed off with all of their wealth, and then to pay back what they say they owe them, they have to borrow even more. So yeah, that's really it's an unfortunate situation for China here.
Absolutely. And so this wraps up, I think, 1856. And so within, or 1860 maybe. But so within about 40 years, you've gone from being the celestial kingdom, the center of the world, the emperor of all emperors, to being completely kicked in the nuts and having your military humiliated, having to give up all of your wealth and prestige, and having to put down this massive kind of peasant revolt that cost tens of millions of lives and must have cost just an unimaginable amount of money to put it down. So within 40 years, you just had this pillar of stability completely shaken to its foundation and its future very uncertain all of a sudden. Like sharks smelling blood in the water, other European countries start showing up in China. You have the Dutch, you have the Italians, you have the Portuguese, you have the Germans, you have even the Belgians, everyone starts showing up and they want the same treaties that they extended to the British and the French. We want the exact same deal. And if you don't do it, well, we're going to do exactly what they did to you. We're going to blow up your ships, bombard your ports, and there's nothing you can do about it. And so China all of a sudden has to start honoring all of these treaties. All of the sharks start closing in, circling them, and they have to appease them. And so they start slicing off more and more of their country. More little sections will be ceded as these foreign concessions. Other countries will get to have the same sweetheart deal that we gave to the British and French. Their citizens can commit crimes in our country, but we can't try them in our country. We'll have to just trust in their ju justice system that they will actually face justice, but lots of times they don't, And so not only is a military and economic humbling, it's a cultural humbling too, where all of a sudden we can no longer enforce our own laws in our own country. And so it's just a complete collapse of Chinese power. And again, I've said it a bunch of times, this had been the most powerful country in the world. And as it collapses, it leaves this huge vacuum of how is the Far East going to be governed? Who is going to replace this? Are the Europeans going to become the new power in the Far East? Or is there going to be another rival to China pop up, somebody like, say, Japan? But this really, this undoing of China is probably one of the most influential events in modern history. Completely opens the door to all of the instability that happens in the early 20th century into the rise of the communist government and kind of this desperate attempt in China to kind of circle the wagons and get back our sovereignty, get back our authority, get back our economy. We have so much potential here, but everything kind of collapsed all at once. And how do we sift through the rubble and find the strong foundations of our society and rebuild it into something that's going to be able to withstand the onslaught of modernity?
Yeah, and
And
when you kind of look at like how this played out when you, and looking at modern China, like it makes a lot more sense. Like, what are these motivations? Well, there you have it, right?
absolutely. Absolutely. And that's like why I wanted to talk about it, is just like so we could understand a little bit more about modern China by understanding stuff that happened 150 years ago. It's not that long ago, historically.
No, it's
And
really not.
to see China come back, so they call it the Century of Humiliation, which is about 1839 to 1939. Similar situation in World War II. They got completely ravaged by the Japanese. And it was like kind of the darkest. That was a really bad 100 years, like really, really bad 100 years. But through the wreckage of kind of Imperial China, a new Chinese state has arisen, and it has its own logic and mentalities, and it has these cataclysms in the back of its mind because they are very recent still in Chinese memory. Now, a place that's been around for so long has a very different kind of perception on time as kind of more upstart countries. And this is just my opinion. Maybe this isn't true, but
That a lot of people I've heard that opinion like pretty widely espoused. It makes sense to me.
yeah. And so you're looking at things in a big picture. And if there's one thing that the communist Chinese government has been able to do, it's that they have brought them back as a power. There's been a lot of cost associated with that. The rise of China is going to, have implications on China's future for hundreds of years, as far as, environmental impact and societal impact. How, the laws where you could only have one child led to a huge population imbalance, where there's like 20 million more men than women in this one
Yeah.
particular generation in China.
I've heard some analysis about this and crime rates and other things. It's really interesting.
Yeah, so there's just like these societal impacts of China's reemergence. But at the end of the day, they have delivered the goods, and that's why they're still in power. That's why the Chinese Communist government is in power, is that they've brought them back. And China is no longer groveling at the feet of these foreign barbarians. Well, quite the opposite. Their corporations come to us and grovel at us. We make all the shit in the world. So when the British showed up at the Pearl Delta, they had the Industrial Revolution backing them. Well, all of a sudden, we're the industrial powerhouse of the world. They get our shit from us. And this trade deficit has swung back in their favor. The money is going to China now. People are buying way more shit than China than they're selling to China. So all of these kind of historic wrongs brought on by the Century of Humiliation, the Chinese government is very actively and precisely trying to rectify all of this. And so I think that is kind of their mentality, is that they do want to be number one again. And they've been number one for most of their history. So it's only kind of natural that they would want to be number one again. And
Everybody, as they say, everyone wants to rule the world, right? Everyone wants to
yeah,
be number one, and we see this in history so often.
it
And
seems to be a meme of history, is megalomania.
yeah, why not just like, I mean, although I don't know, China was, it wasn't like China was going around trying to take over everybody else's stuff, or like they were kind of just chilling, and the problems came to them. So
That's
yeah, this
absolutely
could,
true.
yeah.
Yeah, they had this kind of this idea of harmony in East Asia. It had been ruled by these kind of Confucian principles of harmony and certain ways to live your life and to have an ethical construct for society that is all about everybody getting a maximum out of it. So arrangements that will be beneficial to the whole. So it's kind of like this top-down harmonic approach.
Sounds very sustainable. I mean, hypothetically.
And when the Europeans showed up, they destroyed this harmony that had existed, you know. And so how can we get back to something like that? But and then, like, just kind of curiously enough, you know, like, just with the current drug epidemic in North America,
Yeah,
heroin,
opioid epidemic,
the
I think,
opioid
yeah,
epidemic,
because there's a variety of different, opioids that are floating around and causing problems, huge problems. So, yeah.
all, and they're basically coming from two places, and one of them is China. And
Sure.
I don't know if it's the same thing, but it definitely is reminiscent of the Opium War, where, okay, well, you did this to us, we're going to do it to you now. And I
I
guess
think
just like,
it's possible, though, too, like that. I don't even necessarily think it needs to be like you did this to that could maybe be the case, but I feel like it's maybe just closer to home. It's like we made a bunch of money, or others made a bunch of money doing this once. We can just do this again. Like, here's a population with resources that we can sell our drugs to. And I mean, the opioid epidemic, I mean, there's kind of it's been pointed out that it's a very complicated issue, so I don't want to like misspeak here, but as far as I understand it, there's been some revelations that there was collusion by doctors, that these drug companies were definitely kind of having these misinformation campaigns, or maybe just campaigns that were pushing something and maybe hiding the dangers of it, all kinds of complicated things. Like, I think that that all might be coming from inside our own house, but who knows? It is interesting to see that that these things are being manufactured in places like China, and I think Mexico is another big
that's the
place where we
second
see.
one, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
So
yeah,
yeah.
but the same was true in the Opium War itself, is that you had, it wasn't just like the British government determined to sell opium. It was that you had all these business agreements. There's just a lot of money to be made, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And I think that's the same thing today. I don't know if it's necessarily driven by this historic axe to grind, but that might be a part of it. Obviously, you're going to do it because you can make a lot of money. And, you know, that's why people do it. That's the on the boots on the ground kind of motivation to do this stuff. But it takes people in both countries, right? So if you want to smuggle drugs into a country, you need a smuggler. And those are the drug dealers. And which was exactly how the Opium War was. You know, they were smuggling it in. So I don't know, it's maybe not be like exactly the same, but it's at least reminiscent where,
Well, there's a system of distribution that existed with these syndicates, right? Like that these people were doing, importing illegal goods already. So there was already this like system of distribution that in China at least was this like illicit one. I think here there's this like the system of distribution is not illicit. It's very much above board. But it's still kind of a similar situation, at least in my view, because of that reason. But there's of course illicit, distribution of these drugs as well. But I think that there's a very robust, above board one as well.
yeah, as far as, yeah, it's like doctors pushing drugs and stuff.
Yeah,
There's definitely an element of that, no doubt about it.
I think that anyway, we should do a whole episode on this because it is very complicated, and I would love to do some research into it so I could speak a little bit more intelligently on the
Yeah,
topic.
I think that would be really interesting. I watched like one documentary on fentanyl, and just, I guess you could buy like $500 of it because it comes like incredibly potent. And like you buy it from a lab, they send it to you like in magazines. Like they can get it through the customs, like by putting it within magazines. And if you buy like $500 of fentanyl, you can turn it into like $100,000 if you cut it and sell it to its full capacity.
And in that really concentrated form, a lethal dose, I think, can be like microscopic. You can't even see it. So, like, it's
Yeah.
really, really fucking dangerous. Like,
It's
that's a
incredibly
weapon. Like,
dangerous.
that's to me, like, that's like more of a weapon than a drug, right? Like, that's wild.
Yeah, I
Anyway,
think it's like
different topic, but yeah.
500 times more potent than heroin. So the dealers that import it, they have to cook it up and make sure it's not going to be a lethal dose, but it's really easy for them to not do that because they're oftentimes not freaking chemists and scientists, you know, with
Sure.
good lab equipment that can actually make a non-lethal dose. So, yeah.
And this stuff is like showing up in all kinds of places too. Like, if you're gonna be partying or whatever, like, it's a really fucking good idea to get a drug testing kit, a fentanyl testing kit, which are available from all kinds of organizations. I think DanceSafe is one of them, dancesafe.com. So, if you're gonna be partying or whatever, definitely like test for fentanyl before you do anything because it's a huge issue and lots of people have died.
Yeah, no
So,
doubt.
be
It's
careful.
scary. Just, there
If you're
are
gonna do drugs,
drugs.
be really fucking careful.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a drug that can counteract the lethal effects of fentanyl. So if they sell it in like vending machines in a lot of
Yeah,
places.
what is that called? Yes, there are, and that's it's for any opioid, like for if people are,
Yeah.
it's not 100% effective, and it's recommended that you have a little bit of training if you're going to use it. But yeah, it's better than nothing, and yeah, you can pick up that as well. So it's not doesn't hurt to have gosh, what is that called again? It's like on the tip of my tongue. But yeah, having something like that just, you know, with you in your backpack or purse or whatever, just in case, is probably not a horrible idea these days, depending on what your life is like and who your friends are and stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just an unfortunate situation, but it's another one of these times where history kind of it's not a direct reflection, but it's a mirror that you can kind of gaze into and see similarities. And I honestly don't know if it's the Chinese government is like encouraging this, or if they're just looking a blind eye, or if just everything in China is so unregulated that you can have labs doing this. I guess the end result doesn't really matter. It's still kind of like a modern opium war in a sense. So it's just interesting, I guess. Now that the foot's on the other shoe, and yeah, if you wanted to sell drugs, well, you want to go to the place that has the most money, that has the most demand for it. So that's North America, and that's why the British went to China, is because they had the most money and the most demand for it, you know. So
Well, it was the only thing they would trade for, right? Like in that situation too.
Yeah.
So yeah, but it's the other interesting thing that I thought about was the sort of this relationship that we see between the British government and the East Andes, is that right? East Andes Trading Company,
East India.
in East India, sorry, Trading Company, and this kind of model I think we see repeating in other places. Like we have these, well, I mean, hell, who is it? Truman that talked about the military industrial complex. I think
Eisenhower.
Eisenhower, sorry. Terrible at history. That's why you're the main
Oh,
host.
he comes after Truman, so you weren't that far off.
Okay. All right. Right on. So we see this, like, you know, this kind of emergence of this relationship kind of, I think, continuing on with things like that, right? Like, I think that although it was like a trading company, it was taking like military or police actions, right? Like, so there's
Yeah,
these
and the
lines are
British
beginning.
government was like authorizing troops to be sent so they could use them, you know, like.
Yes. So the lines between this, you know, entity and the British government are very foggy and murky, especially because there's all these investors in this company that are part of the British government and
Yeah,
other
yeah.
governments. And I just think that it's interesting how often we see that kind of a situation mirrored in today's world.
It's definitely, yeah, it's interesting to study that company because I guess we kind of think today that, you know, companies are bigger and more powerful than they've ever been, but not really true because you actually had a corporation with a massive standing army that was conquering territory, you know.
It's very fucking wild. We should do a whole episode just on them sometime. It would be very interesting.
Yeah, we really should, yeah, because
The
they're
many
involved in the
crimes of the East India Trading
In the
Company.
American Revolution, they were the ones importing the tea.
Yeah.
But yeah, tea was really the main product that the British wanted. The other stuff was good too, but kind of with the birth of the Renaissance and the Scientific Revolution, caffeine became incredibly popular. And a lot of the Middle Ages was fueled by alcohol because that was kind of the way to drink water, to consume water that wasn't going to be contaminated with bacteria.
Sure, yeah.
But with the birth of kind of coffee house culture, all of a sudden you had these new products, tea and coffee coming online in Europe that were fueling this scientific revolution, this intellectual revolution. And you had this whole culture around it. And those products came from places like China, and the demand for them back home was just so big that, it drove these governments to kind of acquiesce to these incredibly, dodgy, behavior,
Yeah, and it is interesting to kind of think about this too. This is about another drug, right? It's like we need to
Yeah.
get this tea. Like we're super thirsty for it. And
And sugar is in
yeah.
a similar vein with all of the crimes in the New World.
Oh, yeah,
A lot of
gods.
it comes down to the pursuit of sugar. And for a similar reason, it's because it became a part of the culture and that people demanded it. They wanted it. It was worth its weight in gold. And so there was really no price too high to pay for its acquire,
Did we
acquisition.
ever do our Dark Side of Sugar episode,
We
or are we
haven't. I've
saving
just been
that?
building up my little
Okay.
case against sugar.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of cases to be made there, in a variety of different lenses to look through. But yeah, fascinating stuff.
Yeah, looking at the economics of it all kind of gives maybe not an explanation, but you can kind of understand the motivations when it comes to these horrible things that have happened in the world. Lots of times it just comes down to money, and people that are making the money don't have to do the dirty work to get the money. And so it becomes very easy to kind of slip into a moral hazard where you don't see the crimes happening, you just see the money coming in. And
Especially if you're, surrounded in social circles where this type of behavior is like encouraged or like,
yeah.
acceptable and stuff. It's like, oh, ho-ho, I just, took over an island and enslaved all the people and made them farm my sugar. And everybody's like,
Yeah.
oh,
Oh,
yay. Like, so,
Cheerio.
right? Like,
Yeah, absolutely.
yeah.
Absolutely. And it does, if there's so much money coming in, it corrupts the government. The government becomes a part of it. The government acquiesces to it, So it's very subversive effect on both countries having to go through something like that.
All right, well, the Opium Wars. What
Yeah,
a
that's pretty
shit
much all I
show.
had
Yeah, very
today.
sad. Okay, very sad stuff.
And just kind of so yeah, these two conflicts and that Taiping Rebellion, they really kick off this 100 years of just chaos in China, and having this once exalted state be reduced to a beggar, like on its knees. And it is very sad to see it, kind of happen, but it does kind of also illustrate a little bit of maybe the modern Chinese mentality to recover from this period and to become strong again. And it makes kind of some of their actions and motivations maybe more parsable and understandable.
All right on.
Well, hell yeah, dude. That's pretty much all I had for y'all today. Thank you for hanging out.
Yeah, thanks so much for regaling me with another fantastic story from history. Where can people get a hold of us if they want to send us thoughts or questions or suggestions for topics that they would like us to cover?
That's a great question, Luxa. They can reach us through email at adhochistorypod.gmail.com, or you can reach us on Instagram at adhochistory.
All right, fantastic.
Well, hell yeah, dude. Thank you so much for hanging out, and thanks for indulging my historical ramblings. I hope it was coherent in some way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Always a pleasure. And thanks so much, everybody, for listening. Appreciate it.
Thank you all, and we'll see you in the next one.
Don't do drugs or do it really carefully.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind must flower. It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
Now we know.
And knowing is half the battle.
G-I-A.